This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 98. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, and it has a totally redesigned interface. It integrates with Getty Images and Google Apps, so you can get your email and things a lot easier. It has 15 new templates and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10%. Off. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm glad to have you here. Today is an exciting episode because we are joined by two people. One is Darren Meller, my friend, and also Tony Northrup. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks.
Hey, how's it going, Jim?
I am doing great. After Thanksgiving, I'm ready to breathe a little bit, enjoy Christmas, and I don't have a whole lot of shoots planned for the next couple of weeks, but I can just be with family for a while, and then I'm ready to hit it again at the start of the year.
Yeah, I think nice. It is, and I think I'm on the same page, and quite honestly, it's given me some time as well to explore some other photographers and explore what they're doing, and I actually had one of our fans of the show, he mentioned to take a look at one of your videos on YouTube, and he said, take a look at this video. This guy is talking about the difference between Canon and Nikon and why he wants to possibly go over to Nikon but just can't make the move quite yet. It's just something to kind of pick your mind and wrap your brain around, and I said, okay, I'll check it out, and I saw Tony Northrup's video, and I really want to shout out to Rob Ganis. He's one of the listeners of the Improved Photography Podcast, and want to also welcome Tony to the show so we can talk a little bit about Canon versus Nikon, our thoughts on the mirrorless systems, where they stand right now, and possibly since we're in that holiday season, whether or not we should be looking towards a certain camera for either ourselves, for our own gifting, or for the photographer within our family.
Cool. Yeah, thanks,
and
Darren.
The other thing that we need to know this information for is like Christmas rolls around and my Facebook just lights up with friends that I haven't seen in like 10 to 15 years who are like, hey, buying a camera for the wife. What do you think? It's crazy. Everybody, every photographer at this time of the year needs to have some good recommendations on the tip of the tongue.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I actually know too much about cameras to recommend a camera because my mother-in-law just asked me, which camera should I get? And I immediately go into this like spiral of technical details as I think about what she needs and sensor data and lenses availability and flashes and stuff. And anybody else would just be like, oh, I have a T3i. It works great. You should get one of those. Uh-huh, but not me. Right. I way overthink it.
That's right.
I'm like, I'll get back to you in a week. I have to do research to do.
And I go down a similar path as well. We also do teaching with photography like you do, Tony. And I had a student ask me, she just said, okay, as far as Canon, Nikon, which direction should I go? And I had to respond back and say, hey, I need some more information. And those technical gears are just rolling around in my head. Which direction are you taking your photography? Are you doing portraits? Are you doing sports? Do you need those extra megapixels for bringing back those shadows? I mean, just that general question of her just saying, I need some insight versus Canon and Nikon without giving me any background or context or budget. It's a very hard question to be asked.
Yeah, actually, just yesterday I tackled this in a YouTube video, just which camera should you buy? And it ended up being a controversial video, which I didn't intend, but I just kind of gave very basic answers for people who don't yet have a camera. And it was difficult for me to kind of simplify things, like, do I recommend the wonderful Sony A6000 to an absolute beginner, or do I go for a DSLR? Because there are so many benefits, mirrorless versus DSLR. And so many people don't give you any information. And mm-hmm. They just say, which camera should I buy? But yeah, it's different for sports or wildlife or portraiture. Or do you want to go pro? Is it a hobby? Or do you not want to learn about aperture and f-stop and shutter speed?
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
A tough question to answer.
Yeah, it really is. And I think the lens system is one of the very most important choices here because there are holes in everybody's lineup, but especially in the mirrorless lineups since they're newer, you know, you're going to find more holes. But, you know, even choosing between Canon and Nikon, lenses are a big, big choice.
Yeah, the holes in the lens lineups are a real problem. I was just telling somebody the other day people keep wanting me to go to the Sony full frame E-mount, like the A7s. And in fact, we just ordered a couple of A7s, but they have four bodies now and I think six lenses, six mm-hmm. native lenses.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can adapt stuff, but Canon and Nikon have like 150 lenses, native lenses that you can get. And it's hard to give up those options.
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, I mean, if you pick up an A6000 that you used as an example, it's a great camera. I got to play with one this week for the first time. Everybody's been talking about it, and I thought, I've got to get my hands on one of those. So I've been playing with one, and awesome camera in every respect. It's just like this little block. I mean, it's very squared fit. It's a little bit thicker than I expected it to be, actually. I mean, much smaller than a DSLR, but it's just like this block. And it's just such a usable camera, lots of great features, but you are limited on your lens lineup. Let's say you want to go do serious wildlife photography, that's gonna
absolutely
be an
not.
Issue you're gonna have yeah. a real problem. Could you find a lens to go shoot it, go shoot while you're traveling in Yellowstone? Yeah, you're gonna be fine. But if you want to do serious wildlife photography or sports, no, do not buy that camera. It's a bad idea. There just isn't an option for you.
You're never going to get a flying bird with an A6000. You mm-hmm. just won't. You can
right.
put some glass on it, but you're going to need to go for a DSLR if you want to catch something in flight, because you just need the focusing speed. And the sad fact of the matter is that the mirrorless cameras just don't focus on tracking subjects very well. We've tested all the best ones, the X-T1 and the GH4, and they don't keep up with the entry-level DSLRs like the D3300. They just, mm-hmm. I can't wait for them to, because every time I go from mirrorless to DSLR, I end up under or overexposing pictures because my mirrorless cameras give me this preview in the viewfinder.
Mm-hmm.
So I always know what I'm actually going to get, and they can show me the histogram in the viewfinder. And so when I go back to an optical viewfinder, it feels so dated and backwards, and you could get the job done, but it's one of those things that's nice to have and helps you get the shot the first time. I'm all about mirrorless, just as soon as I can get the right lenses and maybe some better focusing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something that Jim and I were talking about, as we said, well, where do we think that Nikon and Canon are going to be in 10 years if they don't change their way of thinking and they allow the competitors to continually progress and push new things into cameras? I mean, right now, a lot of people are looking at cameras and they're thinking of things that are nice to have, like Jim and I brought up in a previous episode, how it'd be nice to have NFC built in there so we could strap an NFC sticker to our camera, and we can also associate it with a monopod and say, okay, our camera's going to know right away we need a sports mode because we're shooting a football game. And
this is really smart.
Yeah, it's really smart, and I think that would be eventually something that it's going to need to make its way into Nikon and Canon cameras, but they're so going with putting these $6 or $5 parts in there. What are your predictions as far as 10 years down the road if they keep refusing to kind of conform and go with where, the photography audience is looking at?
Well, my first prediction is that we're going to see mirrorless cameras from both Canon and Nikon, like real mirrorless cameras, not the stuff that they've given us so far,
mm-hmm.
but mounting to their existing DSLR lineups with adapters. And then they'll probably release, like six lenses, kind of like Sony's full frame lineup. So I think we'll see that in 2015 for sure. And then I think because of the adapters that they'll be able to offer, I think we'll see a pretty fast uptake with those mirrorless bodies. Now, I always want to use native lenses with the mirrorless bodies. I really don't like using adapted lenses because it feels like you kind of give up most of the benefits of the mirrorless body, especially the size benefits. Anyway, I think Canon and Nikon are not out of the running. I think if they don't introduce a mirrorless camera in the next year, then it's going to be a real problem for their business. But they're smart business people, and they know the trends. They know what's happening. They're watching Sony.
Mm-hmm, they are. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I think, is it true Nikon is using Sony sensors in there, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, have a source for that, but that's what everybody says. So I've never seen them admit it, but.
Yeah, they definitely are using Sony sensors. I think one interesting thing is photographers seem to be very connected with the sensor and how that impacts the camera. But very, very important, maybe even more important, I don't know if we could say that, but very important is also the processor. And that's something that we don't talk about very often. And Nikon uses processors from Fujitsu in most of its cameras. And so, often, in fact, as I'm watching kind of the rumors sites, Canon rumors, Nikon rumors, Sony rumors, etc. Sometimes I'll read a rumor of an upcoming camera and you say, well, clearly that's not true because there isn't even a processor that can do that yet. And usually the processor's going to, we're going to find out about that sooner.
Are you thinking of the 4K video being added to the EM1? That was one case where I said, there's no way that camera can start handling 4K video through a processor upgrade or a software upgrade. It's just too heavy.
Right.
But I don't totally follow you. Why the importance on the processor. It's not something I ever think about.
Well, yeah, because the processor is going to control a lot of what's going to happen. You know, like the example you gave, you know, the processor is going to control, you know, is 4K video even possible? Well, can the sensor do it? Well, yeah, I mean, most sensors can because we have way more megapixels than we need from a megapixel countdown. But then something's got to actually process that information. And so if you watch the, you know, we always hear, you know, Sony announced a new sensor. Maybe it's going to get filtered into the cameras. But I rarely hear somebody say, Fujitsu announced a new processor. Look what we're going to be able to do soon. And sometimes it's a good tip off into what's going to happen.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've never thought about it. I'll also add that in the realm of 4K video, what limits most of the manufacturers is heat distribution. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why the A7S has 4K recording, but not on camera. When it processes it in camera, there's no way to distribute the heat. So they just have to kind of offload that. It seems like only Samsung and Panasonic have really figured out how to handle the heat. And that's why we see 4K cameras only really from them in the affordable realm outside of like the high-end Canon video cameras.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. So it comes down to more of a form factor thing for Sony to be able to incorporate that within the engineering within the camera. So that's awesome. Wow.
That's my take.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, and speaking of form factor, in a way, I think it's a little bit unfortunate that this whole category of cameras has been branded as mirrorless. Because, you know, the mirror, whatever, it gets the image up so you can see it, you know? We can either do it with a mirror or we can take it right off the sensor. I'm more excited about some of the other things that are happening in the mirrorless cameras that, you know, may or may not have anything to do with the fact that there's no mirror in them. Things like just the connectivity of our cameras has way, way lagged behind where they really should be. I mean, you look at the connectivity of a cell phone that's far less expensive than a DSLR, and our 7000 DSLR can't even come close to competing with the connectivity. You know, great, the mirror's out, and that can do some new cool things from an engineering standpoint. But also, if we're rethinking the camera, let's talk about Bluetooth. Let's talk about NFC. Let's talk about, you know, getting much better connectivity, better screens on our camera, better battery life, all that kind of thing.
You know what I have to do when I take a picture that I really like and I want to put it on Twitter or Facebook? I pull out my cell phone and I take a picture of the back of the camera. Mm-hmm. And then from my cell phone, I upload this like terrible version of the picture of a picture of an LCD. And, you know, I have cameras with Wi-Fi and all that stuff, but even when they have those features, it's so cumbersome
so
to get
bad.
Them to connect. It's just not worth the trouble.
Yeah.
And I can't figure out why a cheap cell phone can take pictures and put them on Facebook instantly, but my $3,300 D810 to get something online is such a pain.
Oh yeah, totally. It's crazy. In fact, I was just in Iceland, as many of you know, listening, shooting with some readers of the website, doing one of our free photography workshops. And you know, there were, you know, maybe 15 of us who were in that specific spot shooting a waterfall. We all shot it, and then I found myself reaching in my pocket and grabbing my cell phone. And I looked out and I thought, well, that's kind of funny. I just got all these pictures with the DSLR and I'm still grabbing my cell phone. And I looked down the line and about half of the people had grabbed out their cell phone after they were done. You know, everybody kind of shot with their DSLR, but before we left, everybody whipped out their cell phone. Because you want it there in cell phone form where you can actually use it without it being a pain in the neck.
And can I also talk about just another, the Emperor has no clothes thing? The user interface on the Canon and Nikon cameras,
on
most cameras, once you use an iPhone or an Android phone with their touch interface and the intuitive pushing and pulling and pinching, you go back to your camera and you have to poke those buttons and those antiquated menus. How can they not update the user interfaces?
Oh, yeah. It looks like Windows DOS. It totally does. Black screen with, you know, very digitized looking text. You know, a new photographer looks at a camera, you know, gets their T5i. They look at the back of it and you say, oh, change your shutter speed. Which one's the shutter speed? It's just a bunch of random numbers in random order all over the screen. They don't know what that means. Are we serious that there's no way we could organize it to be quick for professional photographers? You know, I don't want to have to click into like four things to get there, but that could also be easy for people. I'm sure there's a way.
Oh, and the antiquated LCD screen on the top that looks like some 1980s Casio watch.
Yeah.
Can't we get like a color display or e-ink or something? They've literally not updated that in like 40 or 50 years.
Yeah.
It's so true. No, because Jim did this article and he said, in no way, shape, or form am I comparing a 5D Mark III to a cell phone. But if you look at it, I mean, the screen on our cell phone, it's so much better. And that we just can't even share. And like that's what I was kind of thinking of when Tony was saying, I'm taking a picture of the back of my LCD screen on the camera. And that's where kind of the mirrorless systems aren't adapt. I mean, they're adapting faster, but you're looking at these really high-end Canon and Nikon cameras, and those screens, you're not even getting very much DPI out of the photo, so you can't even really tell until you bring your computer to your laptop or your desktop whether or not you got a good photo before you even leave the scene.
Oh, yeah. And think,
I'm sorry.
There must be a little bit of delay. Another thing that is a huge difference, and not just the connectivity, but also think about your phone. If you want to give your phone like superpowers today and you're like, oh, man, I wish my phone could do QuickBooks. You just download the app. And so what if you want your camera, your expensive $7,000 camera to do HDR? Pfft, bummer. Wait for a couple of years until it comes out and then buy a new camera. What is
Sony.
That? Why can't
Sony
you download
cameras.
Apps? So Sony
the
has the...
cameras can do that.
Yeah, like, they have the Play.
You can install little apps in it and they have an app store and everything. And
yeah, and it's called the... What's
way
it called?
Overpriced.
Play.
I don't know because I never actually got it to work. But
I was going
to
call it the Play.
I was in there and then I tried it and it didn't work.
I was going to call it the Play Mate store, but I don't think that's it. It's the Play Live.
That would be something different.
I can't remember. Something like that. But it sounds like a pretty clunky process. I haven't done it myself.
Yeah, same here. Like, and when it comes down to it, and I've looked at some of the things that Sony's come out with, because when they announced the QX10 and the QX30, those cameras that you can use, you just use the Sony app and you can actually use it with an iPhone, an Android phone, etc. Is that similar to what you're talking about, Tony?
No. I mean, like in the A6000, which is a little mirrorless camera, you can just install an app that will, for example, do a time lapse for you and blend everything together. Or theoretically, it could do anything software-based. Independent developers could put things in the Sony store and you'd be able to install them. So it kind of means the camera has unlimited potential, which I think is cool. If you think about it, one of the reasons the 5D Mark II revolutionized everything was the Magic Lantern. People figured out how to hack it so they could put their own features in there. And Magic Lantern, this third-party hack that never worked especially well, changed an industry just because it allowed people to customize cameras. So I don't know why Canon and Nikon haven't jumped on this and allowed more people to customize things. I think they're worried about reliability problems and whatnot, but cell phone manufacturers have figured it out. So maybe Samsung will work it out.
Yeah, and I think reliability is a major concern for them. I was talking with a certain person who works at a major camera company a little while ago, and he said, you know, we get the spec sheet for new cameras a year and a half before they're ever announced. And, you know, that made me think two things. One, they're putting a lot of time into each one of these cameras to make sure it's a polished machine before it gets out. That was the problem with the D600, right? And it was a huge liability. And, you know, now they're getting class action lawsuits against Nikon because they didn't watch their reliability on that camera with the oil spots. But at the same time, a year and a half product cycle until you can announce it is probably too long to compete with technology and the pace that it's moving at. You know, we're getting a new iPhone is released every single year. And so technology is moving at a faster rate than a year and a half spec sheet.
I can definitely see that because it's almost like, and I know that the Canon support and Nikon support reps or any camera company support reps that you're going to call are going to not really know what's going on with it. But then when you see people out there testing some of them, and especially because I've been eyeballing the new Canon 100 to 400 millimeter version 2 f5.6 to 6 or f4.5 to 5.6 lens, there's only really two of them in the country right now. Scott Kelby's shooting one, and I think someone else is shooting one right now. But that's just kind of a concern for me because I'm torn because I'm wondering whether the technology in the 7D Mark II is enough to make me want to jump from my 70D, especially after hearing we had Mark Gee, he was a really awesome astrophotographer from New Zealand on the show. He was saying that in his experience, the 6D actually performed better with night photography at higher ISOs than the 5D Mark II and the 5D Mark III. So, I mean, things like that really surprised me, and they kind of make me antsy to want to jump for even around the Canon system itself, because if you look at the 7D right now, it's a mini 1DX, and I've actually spoken with Canon support reps, and they've told me this, that it's a marriage between the 5D Mark III and the 70D. So if they would have slapped a full-frame sensor in that bad boy, I mean, it would be better than the 1DX in a lot of senses, faster processor, bigger sensor, more megapixels, etc. So it has me really perplexed in which direction to go as a professional photographer even.
I actually have some data here. I've been analyzing the 7D Mark II's sensor performance, and it's a 1.6x crop, but if you were to scale that same performance up to a full frame, the ISO scores, the amount of noise, would be pretty much identical to the 1DX and the D810 and, you know, the A7R and all these other top-end cameras. Like, the sensor in that, for the small size, is state-of-the-art. Nothing is better than it. It's just it has a little bit smaller sensor. I feel like Canon made this huge folly of going with a 1.6x crop instead of a 1.5x crop. And because of that, it's about 10% less sensor size. Their ratings are always going to be 10% worse, even when they match technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that as well, because I've had students and other people ask me about, you know, what's the advantage of using a crop sensor versus the full frame? And I always have to switch gears in my head and say, okay, are they asking about a Nikon with the DX bodies and the FX, or were they talking about the Canon? And I have to say, okay, am I in the 1.6 area or am I in the 1.5 area? So I think that Canon making that move really wasn't a smart move in that sense, because the smaller sensor, from everything I've learned about cameras so far, getting a bigger sensor is going to produce better shallow depth of field, and it's going to just give you more detail. I mean, look at our medium format and our large format cameras. They're designed for a specific reason, to capture the most data out of a photo as possible.
Yeah, that's right. Well, before we go on, let's take 1 second and thank our sponsor for this episode, and that is Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to make your website. I've tried lots of different things, and you know, each one of the different options out there has its benefits and its drawbacks. But Squarespace, like, you know, I started my site. I went on there, bought the plan, which starts at $8 a month. Got on there, start working at it, and like, I don't know, 20-30 minutes later. It was done, like ready to publish to the world. It was polished, finished. It had the mobile site ready and always loads. Never have a problem with the reliability. It's just been awesome.
Yeah, and that's so important, because your portfolio is something you need to update regularly. Like for me, I'm always trying to take a picture that will go into my portfolio. That's always my goal, unless I'm working for a client. And when I do get that picture, I want to be able to drop it in and not have it be a pain. And with my Squarespace site, I find I can just drop it in there in seconds. And you don't have to know anything technical at all, no HTML skills or whatever. It's literally drag and drop. It's the most amazing system for publishing your pictures around.
Yeah, and it just looks great. I mean, looking at both your website and looking at Jim's website that are both built on Squarespace, the flow of it, just from a user standpoint, I can get around and get to every section of both your websites with ease, and that's what I love about the layout. So if I want to get to know you more as a photographer, look into the products that you offer as a photographer and instructor, it's easy to find those things on both you and Jim's site. So I love the layout. It's very clean from a user perspective as well.
Yeah, and it works on every ridiculous mobile device you might have, iPhone, iPad, Android phone, Microsoft phone, whatever. You pull it up and it just looks great. You don't have to worry about it, you know? They just did a great job.
Yeah, it's very nice. Well, and also, it's a great time to start out with Squarespace, because they just launched Squarespace 7, which has some really cool features that we already mentioned a couple of them, but some really nice things happening in Squarespace. To start a trial with no credit card required, and to start and building your website today, you can go to squarespace.com and remember to use the offer code IMPROVE, and that'll give you 10% off your first purchase, and you can also get your domain name that way. So that's promo code IMPROVE. Squarespace, start here, go anywhere. Well, we've talked a lot about the cameras themselves, and I want to get into some of the creative stuff that you do as well, Tony, because you're doing some really cool things.
Thanks.
Let's take 1 second, though, and talk about Canon and Nikon. That was kind of one thing that tipped Darren off, got him interested in some of the things you were doing. So you were talking about switching to Nikon, and what is it that you're seeing?
Well, we have been doing commercial photography for a long time, which is very, very demanding on image quality because commercial clients do not accept noise in their pictures. And people think, like, they always say, this camera has no noise under ISO 800. But our pictures were consistently rejected, taken at ISO 100 on a 5D Mark III, which is Canon's basically their cleanest image, except for the 1DX.
And is that stock or selling to an individual?
Some of both.
Okay.
The individuals aren't always so picky, but the stock sites are extremely selective.
Yes,
so what
they
we
are.
Then have to do is go in and edit out all the noise manually. So you find all the shadows and you have to clean it up, and it's very, very time consuming. It takes hours and that costs money. A better camera can easily pay for itself. And for that reason, we picked up the Nikon D810, and it was so much better than the 5D Mark III in every way when we did our comparison that we were happy to switch. But then I ran into a roadblock because I couldn't find a replacement for my Canon 70-200 Mark II, the IS version. And everybody just says, just get the Nikon version or get the Tamron or the Sigma. But these lenses all have one thing in common, and that's pretty severe focus breathing.
Mm.
If you're shooting a headshot, if you're at close range, all of those lenses are right about 125, 128 millimeters instead of 200 millimeters.
Yes.
Like, the camera thinks it's 200, it's marked 200, but when you're up close, it's really like 125. And that means you have to take like a couple of steps towards your subject. And that means you don't get the same tight field of view, you don't get the same background blur or the same a compression of the facial features, like noticeably different. And for something like a wedding, where you're working at a distance, or sports, where you are working at a range too, you really need all those millimeters. And I don't think they'd sell very well if they sold it as a, you know, a 60 to 125 millimeter lens. And so I couldn't get rid of my Canon. And I think for me, the lesson was sometimes you pick a body and then find the best lens for it. But sometimes you start with the lens and then you pick the best body you can use. So we use the Nikon whenever we can. And in the studio, we've been working at some shorter focal lengths. You know, we had baby shoots. It's okay to shoot that at a shorter focal length, and so we could use the D810. But for weddings and portraits, especially outdoor portraits, we've been using the 5D Mark III still with that Canon 70-200. I just can't replace it.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. You know, when I go over to Canon land, because I shoot Nikon normally, when I go to Canon land, I pick up the 70-200 and a couple things are different. Well, one thing just drives me nuts on the Canon version of it, since I'm so used to the Nikon, is the tripod collar. You know, on longer lenses, you're going to get a little thing that sticks down from the lens and out, like a little foot that comes out, so you can attach the lens to the tripod instead of the camera. Because if you were to attach the camera to the tripod, the lens is so heavy it's pulling too much on the mount. So it has this little foot there, and on the Nikon version, it's deep between the lens and the foot, so you have enough room to fit in your fingers, and I kind of use it as a handy hold.
Yeah,
on the handle. Canon, it's squished in there, and so you can grab it with like your fingertips or something, and it always gets in my way. It drives me nuts using the Canon 70-200 for that reason.
Yeah, the bigger telephotos in the Canon world have a proper grip, but you're right, that's a pain. I always just end up carrying it by the body, which I know you're not supposed to do, but I've never broken a mount yet.
Mm-hmm.
I should also bring up wildlife stuff, because we do a lot of wildlife work, and Nikon just kind of falls down here. They've done such a good job at upgrading their full-frame bodies, but for wildlife work, you really want to be working with a crop body, because they have so much more pixel density in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not exactly like a 400 millimeter f/5.6 doesn't become, you know, a 700 millimeter f/5.6 or a 600 millimeter f/5.6. It's more like a 600 millimeter f/8, because you don't get the same depth of field and you don't even get the same sharpness since you're just using the center of the lens. But when you can't get close enough, like when you're shooting birds who don't want to get super close to you, it really helps to get all that extra detail from having all the pixels crammed right in the middle of the lens, because you would have to crop anyway. So with a 5D Mark III, if you crop 1.6x, as if you were the same crop if you were using an APS-C body, It becomes like an 8-megapixel sensor, which is old and antiquated. But with the 7D Mark II, I get 18 megapixels out of it. So I love APS-C bodies, and specifically the 7D Mark II, for wildlife work. And in the Nikon world, there's not a good one, really. There's the D7100, but the buffer is just so, so small. And Nikon doesn't have this Canon 400 f/5.6 that I just love so much. This like 13-year-old prime lens, which is $1,300 and unbelievably sharp, way sharper than any of those zooms under like $3,000.
Yeah, I would
so
say for...
I still grab the Canon for that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think for sports and wildlife, I see an edge that Canon has. You know, on the expensive end, in the very expensive end, you know, they got the 200 to 400 with the built-in teleconverter, which is just awesome. I mean, that's incredible
to have.
Very
cool for sports.
You have the 200-28 is another one that I really like on Canon, because I get questions all the time, like at least once a week. Somebody will say, you know, I'm shooting my kid's basketball game, I'm shooting my son's, you know, football game under the lights. And that's just one situation where most cameras, you know, your average, you know, average person's DSLR, a hobbyist, you're just really not going to be able to take pictures. You know, you're under the lights at a high school and they're never well lit, a night game.
Yeah.
And you want a long lens. It's just about impossible unless you're really going to spend some money. But that 200-28 from Canon, I think is a great buy for that kind of person. And whenever I get that question, I say, I hope you're on Canon, because that's a winner. You know, it's a fast lens. 200's not real long, but it's doable. And so I love when I can recommend that lens.
That's one of the lenses I recommended in the video and specifically cited as an advantage that Canon has. And
oh, there you
said,
go.
But Nikon has the 200 F2. It's even better. But the 200 F2 is 6.5 pounds and it's $6,000.
Right,
whereas
yeah.
Whereas the Canon 200 F2.8 is like $700 and it's super lightweight and just built like a brick.
Mm-hmm. And on the other side of the fence, to be fair to Nikon, I would say in wide angle land, Nikon wins, at least in my opinion. I'm sure reasonable minds can differ on it. But that Nikon 14 to 24 was like sent from heaven. Beautiful, beautiful lens. The Nikon 16 to 35 is decent, probably just as decent as the Canon. I feel like on the wide angle area, Nikon probably has a little edge.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's no replacement for that Nikon 14 millimeter.
Yeah, and the pixel density that you have on the D810 as well. I mean, the higher pixel count, and that's also what Tony was saying in the video, is if you want to recover those shadows and those things in the photo, you need that pixel density to do so. And that's one thing that I think, even though the Canon bodies, and that's what really kind of stood out in the video, was that even though the Canon bodies have less megapixels, when you look at the lenses, which are transforming an analog image and being processed into a digital image using the sensor with that combination, we're not really seeing that much of a difference between the megapixels between the D810 and, let's say, a 5D Mark III with certain lenses. So that was one thing that really sparked my interest.
Yeah, one of the things people don't realize is that they'll get like a D3300 kit lens, and the D3300 is 24 megapixels. But the kit lens that comes with it, DxOMark rates it at 9 perceptual megapixels. Mm-hmm. So you get nowhere near your 24 megapixels. So there's no point in choosing the Nikon over, say, the 18 megapixel T5 for those extra megapixels, because you just won't realize that benefit until you put some better glass on it.
Right.
People use it, and by the way, all the kit lenses that come with all the cameras are terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever recommend buying one of those kit lenses. They're just generally overpriced and soft.
Yeah, friends don't let friends. And Darren, that's a good point about the D800. The whole D800 line, D800, D810, D800E, whatever. It's the ultimate landscape camera, in my opinion, at least. And I shoot a lot of landscapes. So for me, I can't leave it. It's fantastic. You know, landscapes are the kind of thing that you do blow up. You know, you are going to put a 60 inch on your wall. Like I have in my living room downstairs, a huge print. And so I do like that. Plus, a lot of times with landscape photography, you know, you get caught in the moment, and often I'll take a landscape and I'll say, whoa, I really need to crop this sucker for the composition to work. And so
yeah.
I love to be able to do that. So for me, for a landscape photographer where you're not so much concerned about speed and all those other things. The D800, D810, D800E, all of those, you know, very similar. Awesome, awesome camera.
The D810 was actually my top-end recommendation for landscape photographers, and I do absolutely love it. I love the Sigma 24-105 for landscape work.
Now, the only thing I don't like about the D800 line is the D800 graveyard that is sitting next to me on my desk. The weather sealing could be improved. I would not mind that at all. We had
both of our 5Ds die when we were in Glacier not too long ago. We got caught in a surprise rainstorm, and the rain just killed them. And I couldn't believe it. I felt like these cameras are weather sealed. They're going to be fine. Our GH4s survived just fine. Couldn't believe it.
Huh, that is crazy. Mm. Yeah, this D810 is, it still smells like a new camera. It has less than 100 frames on it. I took it out to shoot. I was doing a shoot with an Olympic swimmer, and it just this, I mean, tiny, tiny splash, tiny amount of water, much less than I've had in rainstorms and with this camera, with D800s before. Got on it and it's fried. I took it I sent it into Nikon and they said unrepairable. Took it to my local camera store and they said unrepairable. It's just a $3,000 paperweight.
Can I offer you some encouraging words?
Please.
People pay a surprising amount for broken cameras.
Oh yeah?
I got $800 for my broken 5D Mark II.
Oh,
and like a broken Canon 5D Mark III will go for about $1,100. So I don't know what the Nikon goes for, but you will be able to recapture a good chunk of the money, maybe half or two-thirds of the cost of a used model.
Oh, hey, that's nice. All right, well, I'll put it up. I was planning to seriously paperweight this sucker, but that's good.
No, you can get most of your money back out of it. I think people are just refurbishing them, combining them together.
Yeah, another thing that I have become very concerned with Nikon is their repairs. So, I guess it's been maybe 2 years or so, Nikon announced that they're no longer servicing parts to any third-party repair shops. And so it effectively killed a lot of them because any of those parts that aren't, you know, easily replaceable, they got to get from Nikon, and Nikon just said, nope, no more parts. And so...
Wow.
I sent in my D800 for repair a couple months ago, and Nikon sent it back to me and says, can't fix it. And I was really surprised because it was just the LCD screen that was not functioning. You know, it was broken. Actually, the glass on the outside was fine, not cracked, but the inside, the LCD screen was cracked anyway. So I thought, okay, this will be pretty easy. Just replace the screen, right? I've done that on my iPad. It was easy. And they said, no, we can't fix it. And so I called them and I said, you know, why won't you fix the camera? You know, just switch out the screen. And the lady said, well, we have a policy that if we can't repair the camera up to, you know, what she kept saying, its default condition. I said, what do you mean by that? And she says, as good as new. If we can't repair it to as good as new, we won't repair anything at all on it. And I said, no, this camera works great. I've tested it. I know when a camera has problems. It shoots fine. It shoots sharp. There's nothing wrong with it. Just fix the stupid screen. And she said, nope, we won't. And so I took it into my local camera store and they swatched it out real quick and it was done for $200. And so I don't love that about Nikon. I think that's a very poor policy.
I had a similar problem with Canon. They refused to fix my 5D Mark III. And really all that was broken was the back dial didn't work and some of the buttons. But it did have water damage. And I guess they felt like they couldn't get it into like new condition. But they could have. Probably, it worked okay. I'd been using it. It was fine. It was kind of a pain to, I couldn't use the back dial, so I had to improvise. Anyway, I felt like they could have fixed it or made it better, even if they couldn't make it like new and they passed.
Yeah, I think no matter what they say, the real thing is they're like, yay, somebody gets to buy a new camera from us.
Yeah, they win either way.
And I guess I'm feeling a little bit less like an idiot here by buying what I call idiot insurance. I buy a lot of my camera gear from a large store that's kind of like Warren Buffett's Best Buy. It's called Nebraska Furniture Mart. And I'll buy what I call the idiot insurance. That means if I bring pieces of the camera in there, as long as the serial number is still matched up on there and I didn't break it like right in front of them, they'll go and just swap it out if it's beyond repair. So it does add about probably $300 to $400 to the cost of a camera, or to the cost, it was about $400 or $500 added to the cost of a 6D with a 24-105 kit lens attached to it. But I think it's worth it. If I drop the camera and I bring them pieces, I get replaced, as long as it's, you know, not obvious that I broke it on purpose or something like that.
Yeah, certainly I wish I had that. I will say we have professional insurance on all of our gear, but at the same time, we also have a deductible.
Same here.
And so far, it's just never been worthwhile. Like, because once you make a claim, you know, they're going to raise your rates on you, and you end up paying for it over time. So it's never been a big enough amount that I've ever made a claim.
Right. It would really only be useful if, you know, somebody broke in and stole your gear, you know, and you had a $30,000 loss in a night or something.
Yeah, or somebody trips over a wire in the studio and cracks their head and sues us.
So you're talking about it's E&O insurance, errors and omissions insurance, or just for the gear itself?
Yes, we have all of that stuff.
Oh, just okay.
Professional business insurance, yeah. But for the gear as well.
Awesome. Yeah, that's what I use as well. Mine's it's E&O, and then also it covers up to $15,000 with my gear. And then, you know, anything that I might do wrong as far as maybe format a memory card at a wedding, hopefully that never happens, or a light stand falls on someone, or a lens falls off out of a window when I'm leaning out to do a shot or something, all of that's protected. And it's kind of a good thing for a lot of photographers to look at, even though it deviates a little bit from what we were talking about. But being insured, if you can tell your client that you're insured, especially if it's a commercial client, I think that can really help you out a lot as well.
I formatted a card accidentally. PhotoRec saved me. It's this free DOS tool, but it completely went and recovered all these files that I thought I had just completely lost. Works great.
And is that a free program?
Yeah, absolutely free. It's an open source program. It works on Windows, Mac, just about anything else.
Oh, I haven't tried that one.
A good tip is if you get hassled by security for taking a picture of like the Empire State Building and you know it's within your legal rights, just delete the picture in front of them. And then take that memory card out of your camera, put it in your pocket. When you get back home, as long as you have legal rights to it, you can use that tool to recover it again.
Yeah, that's a good point. And if you're going to do it, do erase all images, not format card. It's going to help you to get it back too.
Yeah.
And also if that one doesn't work, and I have tried on a card that had problems, I tried one program and it found a certain subset of the photos, tried a different program and it found different photos, not necessarily the same ones.
Really?
So try a different couple programs if you're missing some of them on the on there. The one that I always use is when you buy one of the professional cards from Lexar or from SanDisk, it comes with software. There's a little tiny piece of paper when you buy the card, and you usually just throw those away. Keep the little card, put it in your desk drawer, because if you ever need it, you know, it's there.
Yeah, it can be a lifesaver.
And Lexar is awesome with it. They if you buy one of their professional cards, you can send it in to them. They'll do the professional recovery and send you a new card. Like, that's pretty cool.
Oh, I did not know that. That's great. That's a great feature.
They're really cool.
Expensive service.
Yeah, that can't be cheap. They must not be using it real often, because I can't imagine they could do that on mass scale.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the creative stuff, Tony. You shoot a lot of different stuff. Looking through your portfolio, all just very, I'd get, maybe we could call it trendy kind of commercial work. Lots of fresh and modern kind of styles. What do you want to achieve with your photos? Is it about selling photos? Is that your ultimate goal, or do you do a lot of personal work? What do you shoot for?
Well, at times I'm an amateur photographer. When I'm acting as an amateur photographer, I'm taking pictures just to gratify myself. And so what I want to take pictures of kind of changes. But when I'm a professional photographer, I'm taking pictures to satisfy someone else's needs. So I am kind of in their head and thinking about what they want. So a lot of the times, much of our commercial work is actually very, very dull. But I don't put the super dull stuff in my portfolio. But most of the commercial work, especially the stock stuff, is conceptual. So you think about an idea and you find a way to convey it. So it could be choosing healthy foods, or it could be weight loss, or it could be fighting with your spouse, or, you know, helping your children in school. So you think about this and then you find some way to capture it using the set and the props and the models that you have available. And that's one of my favorite types of photography.
Very cool. I'm looking through here. You have lots of wonderful images from lots of different locations that you've been able to shoot. What's your, if you had like, hey, I get one photo to represent myself, what's it going to be? What's your favorite photo of all time that just says, hey, look at this, I'm awesome. One that you're most proud of, I guess, is a way to say it.
Look at this, I'm awesome.
That's right. Well, which you say all the time, right? When you meet people, like in the grocery store line. I can just picture myself. You doing that.
I point at my face. I always tell people, put your best picture first on your portfolio and your second best picture last. And so I don't even remember exactly what those pictures are, but I know I followed those rules when I set up my portfolio.
I think the first one
is a picture of my wife in her red dress.
Yep, I can confirm. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. And what do you like about it? So let me describe the picture for you, since this is audio. You know, it's a picture of your wife. She's in a red dress that's kind of silky. You know, you can kind of see through the light kind of coming through. It's backlit with a kind of a greenery in the background. And there's, you know, just this little hint of exposure on her. She's almost a silhouette.
Yeah, exactly. And that was, it is also a conceptual shot, though the storytelling might not necessarily convey. I know the storytelling elements I was trying to convey, so I can't necessarily see it as an outsider, but she's sitting on a suitcase, and the story behind it was a woman who kind of escaped from a party and decided to just bail, and she's, you know, waiting for a train, but it's raining, and she's just killing time. So that was the concept behind it, and parts of what I love about it are probably things that the viewer doesn't see. Like my wife and I, we worked together that day, and we just made a really great team, and we had a great moment. So I actually think these are some challenges that you have as a photographer, because it's difficult to assess your own pictures and know what the best pictures are, because you carry all these extra emotions with you and memories. So I know the story I was trying to convey, and I have all these positive feelings about that day. But nobody else sees those things. They just see this two-dimensional image. But other people seem to like that picture, so.
Well, very cool. Yeah, sorry, Darren, go ahead.
No, I like it a lot, and I think that it's really awesome that both you, Tony, and both Jim have the opportunity to work with your wives, because Jim's wife is always helping out with a lot of his photo shoots when it comes to portrait work and things like that. So I think if you can just find a partner in crime to help you out, I work with my father, and having someone with you to kind of have that extra set of eyes can help in so many different ways. I mean, believe me, from portrait photography to coming up with a different concept for posing, anything, I just think that that second set of eyes and that second mind really helps you out in so many ways.
Yes, and you're not annoying them when you're stopping to take pictures every 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. It makes the relationship go much more smoothly when you both have cameras.
Yeah, that's for sure. Tony, do you have a lot of your photos have your wife as a model? Do you have a hard time working with your wife in that kind of relationship where you're directing her to act out a certain part, to look a certain way?
I find it funny that you think I direct my wife. You don't know Chelsea very well.
No, that's not what I mean. I mean, you know, when you're giving posing directions, that kind of direction.
Oh, that's what I mean. Exactly. She's a very, very good model. And the reason so many of my pictures feature her is she just happens to be the very best model that I know. She's also an amazing photographer. And those two things really work together. And for example, that picture with the suitcase, you might give me some credit by default for the way it's laid out and the lighting. But it was all a collaboration. She chose the pose, she chose the props, she chose the dress, and we worked together to develop the story and pick the location. So she deserves at least half credit. But
give her 49%.
But in all sincerity, she probably did most of the work there. So Chelsea really directs herself. Now, other models can be very difficult to direct, especially new models. And that's one of the reasons I use Chelsea as a model so much, as she knows what she's doing. But working with a photographer and a model is always a collaboration. The model is more than half of the picture, and having a good model and experienced model makes all the difference in the world with the shot.
Oh, I totally can attest to that. I've worked with just a few before models who are just like truly gifted, like they're just really good at this. And the vast majority of models are, you know, beautiful. That's why you picked them for the shoot. But then when you start shooting, you can tell it just doesn't work. It really is like acting. You know, you can get somebody who looks like a superstar, but if they can't act, they're going to look terrible in the movie. And it really is to that level of importance to have somebody who can pose.
Yeah, because you can't direct every single finger, every piece of hair. You need them to be aware of the light and the pose, and they need to be able to see themselves from the angle of the lens, so that they know that, you know, not to let their elbow fall against their body. They know to separate it a little bit. You know, if you try to manipulate every single part of them, you just can't do it. I will say, when we do shoot, it's nice to have another model. It's nice to have Chelsea there because she's a good model. So she is very good at looking at the person and saying, hey, you need to pull your arm out a little bit here. But modeling is very hard and people underestimate it. And it is exactly like acting. It takes skill. You have to be able to become somebody else. You have to be able to take out emotions, especially in the type of commercial and stock photography that we do.
Yeah, I don't know how many models I've worked with that, like, you set up the first thing, you kind of explain for kind of the look you're going for, and they have this one, like, beady-eyed, open mouth, trying to look sexy kind of look that they do for the whole shoot, no matter what your idea was. And the whole time you're trying to say, we're not really going for that, you know? It's something that you really have to learn. It's an incredible skill.
Yeah, it takes sometimes.
It does take experience, and sometimes I have to even tell my, I say, hey, I know that's a great selfie photo, but we're not looking for your selfie pose with a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I could seriously talk with you and Tony all day about this, but one thing we do in every episode is we have a doodad of the week that we'd like to mention. Is there any doodad of the week, whether it's software, piece of gear, anything that you just find essential to helping you improve your photography, Tony?
I just recorded this video suggesting Christmas gifts for people, so that people can suggest Christmas gifts to their family, because you never know what to tell people to get you.
Uh-huh.
So the first one that comes to my mind is the Rokinon 8mm fisheye, which is available for just about every mount, and it's just super fun.
Is that a full frame or a crop sensor lens?
It's kind of both. On a full frame camera,
it's like circular.
Yeah, exactly. So I had to take a Dremel and like cut the lens hood off to work on a full frame body, but I did it. Anyway, it's only a couple of $100 and it gives you this unique perspective and it's real fun to use and it's not super sharp and it's manual focus, but you get unique and distinctive pictures.
How much does that run?
I think it's a couple of $100, like $200, $225. I wouldn't attest to that, but it's in there.
Awesome. Well, that's very cool.
That's very cool. And we'll go ahead and link to that in the show notes at improvephotography.com/98. And Jim, do you have a dude out of the week that you'd like to mention?
I do. And okay, I can say this honestly, not just because he's on the show, but it happens to be Tony Northrup's DSLR book. I actually have one. So I didn't just look it up and just have one. I have it in my hand. I buy a ton of photography books. I have a big cabinet full of them. I've known the basics of photography for a long time, but I really like the way that you teach the basics of photography here. And since that's what we do a lot, I like to see other people's approach and different examples, things that they give. It's a really well put together book, and it's not just the book. Some people learn better with video, others with the book. Get the book because it comes with 9 hours of video training as well. So very cool. Definitely check it out, and we'll link to it in the show notes.
Oh, thanks so much, Jim. I appreciate the plug.
Yeah, it looks like a cool book. I'll definitely have to add that to my Christmas list for myself because I always tell people that I call myself a photography nerd. Jim calls himself a photography nerd, but I never want to call myself an expert because to me, that's showing myself that I'm shutting off my willingness to learn more about photography. And I want to step out of my house every single day and want to learn something new and pick up something new. And I'm going to mention something real simple as far as my dude out of the week, because as a lot of people are going out and wanting to replace their camera bodies and whatnot, you might have your budget towards a lens, where I'm possibly looking at the 100 to 400 millimeter version 2 from Canon instead of replacing one of my bodies. And my 6D's sensor is atrocious. And so many people message me and say, hey, where do I take my camera in to get it clean? What's the best place? And ever since I listened to Jim's advice, it was brave. And actually hearing Tony use a Dremel to get a lens to work, I think that we're pretty safe to use PEC pads. And that's my dude out of the week, are the PEC pads. They're those lint-free, one-time use pads. They won't scratch your sensor or your lenses. And they come in 100 pack for about $12 on Amazon, and they're a convenient 4x4 sheet of microfiber cloth. You just go in there with your puffer ball, turn the camera upside down when you do manual cleaning, and you can just wipe it right off. Don't use any liquid because that'll attract some more dust to your sensor, but I think it can really just give your camera a fresh set of eyes on the world.
I'll try that out.
It is an awesome, awesome recommendation, Darren. I've been using those PEC pads for years, and what I like about them is, you always get those lint-free cloths. come on, they're not lint free. Every time I wipe one of those on my lens, there's more lint on it after than when I started. Because the problem is, yeah, the cloth itself is lint free and it's going to be resistant to grabbing dust. But, you know, if you have it out of the bag and you will to use it, you know, the lint's got to go somewhere. And even if it may not cling to it as easily, there will be lint on those lint-free cloths. And so these PEC pads are nice because it's one-time use. You take it out of the package, you use it, and you throw it away. And, you know, for 10 bucks, you get like 100 of them. Is that right? So it's really nice. And for cleaning the sensor, I've seen all kinds of complicated setups. I have never, ever had any sensor trouble. Because every time there's a problem, you know, flip up the mirror for cleaning. You go under menu, say, you know, flip up the mirror for cleaning. You have to have at least half battery to do that, or else it won't do that. But you flip it up for cleaning, and you just wipe it. Put your finger on the backside of the PEC pad, and, you know, gently, carefully, just do little circles around. Always gets rid of it. Never a problem.
Yeah, I'm ordering some of those from your site.
There you go.
Awesome. Well, before we let you go, Tony, where can people find your work and find some of these cool videos that I stumbled upon? Where can we lead people to? We'll also put it in the show notes. But for those listening that might have a pen handy, where can they find you?
If you look up, you can go to sdp.io/YT, and that'll take you to our YouTube channel. But, you know, it's easy. It's just a search for me on Google, Tony Northrup, and you'll find my YouTube channel and portfolio and probably books and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Amazing. And you do a live show every week. You guys have tons of stuff going on. So definitely check them up if you haven't crossed paths online.
Every Thursday at 5:00 Eastern time, which is in about 25 minutes from now, we'll be recording a live show. And we look at photos in real time so people can send their pictures in and we get them instantly. So while you're watching, you'll see your picture reviewed if we get to it.
That sounds great, and I suggest everyone go over there and check it out because Tony is awesome, and thank you so much for taking the time to answer my email and come on the show today, Tony. It's been a sheer pleasure working with you.
Thanks so much for having me, and just let me know when you want me back because I love talking to you guys. I could keep this up all day.
We'd be glad to have you.